Welcome to the weekly celebration of the precious mirror awareness. That reflective, open, present awareness always with us, always present, always open, always aware. The Hokyo Zamai. We also have the Jijiyu Zamai, we could translate as, sometimes we say it's self-fulfilling samadhi. We could also say the naturally receptive functioning awareness. I think that's a legitimate translation of Jijiyu. Naturally receptive functioning awareness. Jijiyu Zamai. I would propose this is the same samadhi with a different name as the rare mirror awareness, the precious jewel mirror awareness that is very receptive to whatever is placed before it, with no particular preference and no grasping or rejecting. The mirror where no images stick to it, and yet they're not blocked either. The awareness that's naturally receptive to whatever images arise. This awareness has many names. Those are two of them, near and dear to our particular lineage. The teaching of thusness has been intimately communicated and trusted by Buddhas and ancestors. Now you have it, so keep it well. Protect, maintain, and care for it. We spoke of last week. We'll, of course, continue to explore this teaching of thusness or suchness, because this is another name for the mirror awareness. Actually, it's the way it's the awareness that is the way things are, or the awareness of the way things are, not separate. Suchness that is actually aware. So now we move into some poetic imagery. Filling a silver bowl with snow, hiding a heron in the moonlight. Taken as similar, they are not the same. When you mix them, you know where they are. So now Dungshan is diving into this relationship of the, we could say, the relative and the ultimate. The relative is like the world of particulars. The appearances in the mirror, phenomena, what we sometimes in Zen language talk about, the object you can see in the light. When it's light, you see all the distinguished separate objects, and in the dark, you don't see any separate objects. So the earlier poem of the merging of difference and unity is all about the light and darkness, which are poetic way of talking about in the light is the world of the relative, where you can see multiple things, and in the darkness is the world of oneness and non-separation, where there's no thing that you can see there, right? So that it's good to remember this light and dark metaphor, because it's woven into this poem as well. So (clears throat) when we talk about relative and ultimate, I think it's very easy to fall into a kind of like a theoretical type of thinking about kind of ontological thinking. You know, ontology is like the status of existence of things. Like emptiness teachings, it's easy to get into a very theoretical type of mind about how do things ultimately exist? It's like the status of things. I think, legitimate way to study these two truths of relative and ultimate. But I would propose for this particular topic of the jewel mirror samadhi, which is also, it's going to keep bringing up this issue of relative and ultimate, these two truths. Because we're talking about a samadhi, an awareness, let's look at it in terms of not so much the ontological status of things, like do things exist or not, but let's look at in our experience how these play out, how these two sides play out. In other words, the dual mirror awareness is like just non-dual open receptivity. If there's no object placed before it, before the mirror, it's just non-differentiating awareness. If no thoughts are arising, the mind is just vast openness, period. And then if a thought arises, or an image is placed in front of the mirror, or we see and hear and smell and taste and touch apparent objects, that's like the world of phenomena experienced by the mirror. So in this mirror awareness has these two sides, right? It's like an ultimate non-differentiating awareness, and yet it reflects every particular object in and of itself, differently. If a blue object comes, it's reflected as a blue object, not as a red object. So this is like, you get a sense of like how these two truths we could talk about in terms of mind or awareness, and I think it grounds it more in our experience as opposed to kind of a theoretical abstract idea of like relative and ultimate. And I think when we're talking about these five positions of the relative and ultimate that are woven into this poem, it's all about how this works in our actual awareness. I think this line here is an example. So these images of filling a silver bowl with snow, or I think I would have translated it more symmetrically, like actually it says, or like a silver bowl holding snow, a bright moon hiding a herring. I think it's, simpler, because it's just two basically equal metaphors, two different nice metaphors, talking about the holding container with something kind of in it. So the silver bowl, basically it's like a mirror bowl, right? I think this is the image of a very polished, shining silver bowl, polished to a mirror-like shiningness, filled with this crystal clear white snow. And then similarly, the image of the bright moon, either like we could imagine either the like a full moon, big white full moon with a heron standing in front of it, or maybe the moonlight on the like a really bright full moon night lighting up a field, maybe a light colored field, and the heron is on there. In either case, it's like the silver bowl holding snow, and the bright moon storing You could even translate it as storing or holding the heron. So the silver bowl and the bright moon are like the mirror awareness. And the object before it, you could say, maybe our usual experience is like a silver bowl filled with apples and oranges. You know, they're like, they're like these objects that are clearly, don't seem to be this non-dual awareness. They're just objects in the bowl. And, or like the bright moon with a black crow in front of it. You know, it's, the objects seem to be completely separate from the awareness. So I would hear this kind of line as, in this more subtle awareness, of Zazen type of awareness, it's like the objects in the awareness are almost the same as the awareness. You know, they're like white snow in the silver bowl, or this white heron hidden in the moon. As it says, taken is similar, they are not the same. Or they seem to be this similar or the same, but they're actually not the same. But when you mix them together, like in this image, when you mix the snow into the bowl, actually you can distinguish where they are. You know where they are. A little maybe clunky translation, but we could say, in our experience of this open awareness, the objects that we're aware of, like a thought arising, we can see how there's a way in which we're really settled. We can see the thought is just actually a kind of coming from the mirror. It's kind of, it's arising from this non-dual awareness. Or we studied Buddha nature a lot last year, right? So it's like, especially Dogen's view of Buddha nature seemed like he's saying that all our experiences are manifestations of Buddha nature. He used that word a lot. Everything that's happening is a manifestation of Buddha nature. Buddha nature is another name for the mirror awareness. So if we're settled into this present open awareness, we might start having that sense that that the thoughts that are arising from this nature of mind. And if, you know, outside of meditation, we often get caught up in like, no, the thought, this is really real. This is this thing that I'm thinking about myself or others. This is the like truth. It has nothing to do with my mind, actually. I think we sometimes think this, right? I'm thinking this fact about this person or this situation, and it's like we forget that it's actually like coming forth from this mind. We think it's like about something out there, or coming from out there even. Especially like a really direct experience, like somebody's you know, arguing with us or something. We forget that that's like a reflection in our mirror. We think that there's really somebody out there that's arguing at us. That's like a black crow in the moonlight. But if we start to open, oh, this is a reflection on our mirror, or another way of saying it is, it's an expression of our Buddha nature. This is our own personal experience of this person arguing with us. In that way, it's, the person starts to become more and more like the, like snow in a silver bowl, where it's not really separate from our mind, and yet if we look carefully, we don't just mush it all together and say snow is the same as the silver bowl. So it's talking about this relationship of something, some object contained or reflected in the mirror, but almost the same as the mirror. Do you get a sense of that? Like it's the same color, but you can actually distinguish between the relative and ultimate. And Dongshan's going to get very into distinguishing these. He's like, let's be careful and really watch how our experience is truly unfolding, and be able to distinguish, but without getting into, like, you know, really so-called black and white distinguishing. Right? It's more like white and white distinguishing.
Seem to be contradictory, so I just want to correct my understanding. So you're saying that it seems like they're almost the same, but they're actually not quite the same.
Yeah.
Okay, but
you can distinguish, like, the two truths are almost the same, but you can actually distinguish them.
Okay, but then how are you connecting that with the example that you used about how if I'm arguing with somebody, I think that I'm arguing with something outside, but actually it's my mirror.
Yeah.
I am arguing with myself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And calling it an other.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But how, I don't understand how that is the, that then would seem like, well, that it isn't the same. I mean, no, it is.
It is the same. Mm-hmm.
So,
I mean, in a way, right, this is the whole difficult issue of these two truths. Because ultimately, there is no distinction at all. That's ultimate truth. And yet, there's the appearance. We'd say the appearance is a person arguing with me, and it's different than a person praising me or something, right? We can make that distinction. And we don't want to just blur it into all this ultimate truth where there's nothing happening at all. That's a little bit like Dongshan's childhood problem, right? Like, well, I have eyes and ears and nose and tongue. Why do you say there aren't any? Because ultimately there aren't any. And yet, the conventional truth, the relative truth, is that there are. There's the appearance. So I think one way that classically is talked about is appearance and reality. So you could say in reality, there is no difference between snow and a silver bowl. But there's, in the world of appearance, there's the appearance of snow in the silver bowl. The appearance of a heron. It's almost completely merging into the moonlight. And yet, let's not, you know, fall into this one-sided ultimate where there is no heron or moonlight. It's a beautiful image of, like, white on white, and yet we can distinguish, but it's not a kind of a hardcore, separate distinguishing. At least that's how I'm hearing these images. So appearance and reality. We don't deny appearance. Reality is that there's nothing even in the mirror at all. Appearance is like there's the mirror that can't be harmed or changed by any images in it. No images stick to it. And yet, that side of it doesn't reject the images means like it allows every appearance to manifest. Appearance and reality, or another way of talking about it is the nature of mind is like the mirror, and mind is like the dualistic appearances. So there's mind and the nature of mind, and you could say mind, meaning particularly like conceptual mind, is a manifestation of the nature of mind. The nature of mind is empty awareness. And it's expressed through appearances of separate objects out there, blue and red, and apples and oranges, and so on. Yeah.
The conundrum that comes up for me, and that I don't think I understand Zen well enough to know that if it even addresses this idea, but I get the sense that what is being said is that form and emptiness arise together, that one doesn't come, because you would, in the mind, you would say, well, form must have come out of emptiness. What was the cause of the phenomena all of a sudden coming out of nothing? But how is that handled?
Yeah, always together. And I think form and emptiness is another way of talking about these two truths, right? It's the Heart Sutra's way. Yeah, it's not so much that form comes out of. Like first there's emptiness and then there's form.
Right.
We don't want to get into chronological order.
Right.
But we could say that form is an expression of emptiness, and that emptiness is the true nature of form. So they're always together. They can't be separated at all. And yet, there's these two sides that we can talk about. And Zen and Mahayana Buddhism in particular is really into, like, the Heart Sutra, this whole bringing out these two sides, merging of difference and unity. That poem is also completely about, you know, let's really explore these two sides. Remember, there aren't really two sides. It's just a way of talking to help us understand where we get stuck. So we don't get stuck in one side or the other. And then there's particularly these five positions, five ranks, five positions of Dongshan is like all about the relationship between like form and emptiness or these two truths. You know, most Buddhism only has, there's just one relationship between them, right? But Dongshan's like, it's more subtle than this. It's not just like, you know, we can look at it in these different ways, and it's all, again, I think it's most helpful to look at this in terms of our experience in meditation or otherwise, but less about like how things exist out there, but more like how are we operating in the world. And we'll get into this as it goes on. So taken as similar, or like, you know, they seem to be similar, but they're actually not the same. And when you blend them together, mix them together, you actually can distinguish where they are. Let's leave it at that. The meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. And all through this poem, there's this issue now too with words and language and the kind of this problem and gift of words. So in this case, we're first saying these sort of this is the kind of critique of words. The meaning and that character can also mean like mind, as well as meaning. So you could even say like the mind of the dual mirror samadhi that we're talking about. It's not in the words of this poem, you know, or the meaning that we're talking about here is not in these very words. Dongshan's saying, I'm speaking in words here, but the meaning that I'm speaking of, these words are like kind of rough, because that's the nature of words. Meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Or another translation is, yet a pivotal moment brings it forth. Or a pivotal opportunity or impulse, action or effort. So this is where the Chinese gets pretty vast here. Particularly it's this word qi, this character qi, that means like working or dynamic activity. There's this essay Shobogenzo Zen qi that
is that the response? Which one is qi?
It's a little tricky to see how exactly it's even being translated here. Let's take it out. It's kind of like impulse, yet it meets. And there's a lot of the translations. This is about like 15 different translations in here. Some of them bring up the yet it responds to inquiring seekers, it meets the inquiring student, there are hints to the searching spirit. So it's almost implying like there's as the practitioner, we question, what is this dual mirror samadhi? And we question with words, and we investigate the words, and with this inquiry, the meaning is brought forth, comes forth. So it's like the first, that's the second part of the of that line is like coming or returning. So you could say that's like the respond. It responds. It returns or responds in this active functioning way. Function or energy is another word for this key. Working opportunity, occasion. And then the next characters are like also, or then, present, or going to, or attending. So I think this is a really hard Chinese sentence. It's hard to, you know, see exactly. The meaning's not in the words, that's quite clear in the Chinese, but it responds to the inquiring impulse. I think that the first two, the key is in the response.
Okay.
Yeah.
My hearing is not in the words, but it's in the activity of inquiry and response.
Yeah.
The process.
Yeah, the process, yeah. Inquiry and response come up together. Later in the poem it says that, I think, right? Yeah, in our wholehearted engagement and investigation in this last Dogen study session, right, he kept bringing up this term like wholeheartedly, thoroughly investigate this. You must penetratingly study this issue, you know, over and over. I think it's an energetic engagement with what's happening, and I think in terms of a poem like this, it's so wonderful because it's talking about our mind. It's talking about our awareness, right? So it's using these words, so we're engaging with the words, but we're trying to apply them to our actual awareness and experience in the moment. So that whole, our engagement, with the dual mirror together, you could say the response is the dual mirror's response. When we engage with it, the meaning that's not actually in the words, the true meaning is brought forth and revealed. There's also this similar concept in Zen and Chinese Buddhism of Kano Doko, which means like sometimes translated as mystical communion. Dogen talks about this when he talks about how bodhicitta arises, the aspiration to be completely awake for the benefit of all beings. Like, how does that happen? Can you create that through your own effort? No. Well, do you just sit there and Buddha just zaps you and gives it to you? No. It comes forth from this mystical communion of you, a sentient being, wholeheartedly inquiring with the meeting of you and Buddha. And Buddha, we could say here and now, is just the dual mirror. So us, kind of like, we're like a heron dancing around, wholeheartedly dancing around in the moonlight, investigating this. Our dancing around in the moonlight is meets the moonlight. The moonlight meets us, and together in that meeting of the heron and the moonlight, of the sentient being and the Buddha, of the appearances and reality, the meaning of the jewel mirror awareness is brought forth. So there's, there must be wholehearted engagement, right? It's not a passive thing. Sometimes Zen can seem that way, right? Just sitting there waiting for something to happen. So it's not passive, and yet it's not like, I'm going to do it now either, right? It's just, it's hard to talk about this, right? Because the meaning is not in the words. The meaning's not in the words, yet it responds to the inquiring impulse. Here's Tenshin Roshi Reb Anderson talking about this point here. The meritorious reward of having returned home to the three natures, three treasures, Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, will inevitably appear when there is this kind of non-dual spiritual communion between a living being and a Buddha, when there is a living, breathing relationship between appeal and response. Referring to this communion, the song of the dual mirror awareness says, the meaning is not in the words, yet it responds to the arrival of effort. He translates it here. Mm-hmm. And I think that word key, you could also translate as effort. It's actually his name too, Tenshin Zen Ki. Is this Katagiri Roshi translates it as total dynamic working Zen Ki. Zen is like total, and the key is like dynamic working. So it's like it responds to dynamic working, arrival of effort. The meaning of saying, I take refuge in Buddha, is not in these words, but it responds to our devotion in saying these words. Yeah? I think you could apply that to a lot of our forms in practice. It's all this like form, it's all these words, right? And kind of contrived activities, but the devotion expressed through them brings forth this kind of Buddha meets us there in our wholehearted expression. So he says, if our devotion is total, if we give our whole life to being awake, then there will be a complete response. This is the jewel mirror awareness. It clearly reflects our devotion. It completely reflects our partial efforts. It fully reflects our total effort. In this realm, we get back exactly what we give. When we hold back from awakening, it may seem that awakening holds back from us. This perfect reflection of our holding back is also spiritual communion. This is the dual mirror awareness. Isn't that wonderful? So it's never, you never stray from it. It's just like a little bit of wholeheartedness brings forth a little revelation of the dual mirror, and total wholeheartedness brings forth the total thing. But in each case, it's just the dual mirror reflecting what's placed before it.
Okay, and I accept that image. What gets stuck for me is the idea that the mirror can respond. It doesn't respond. Reflects. And to me, that's a difference, and that's why I don't like that word, respond.
What do you think the difference is?
One's not active. You know, it's... And I like where later on he says, question and answer arise.
Yeah.
The same way we said, form and answer arise together.
Well, how about we, instead of saying non-active, what if we just say non-intentional?
That's something.
So I think there can be a non-intentional response, like a spontaneous response. Like when somebody says, hey you, go like that. You could say that's a response. It's a kind of active response, but it's not. I think we could almost say it's not intentional. It's just an immediate response to the inquiry of "Hey, you." So that's, you know, this whole dual mirror business, right, is we're talking in metaphors. And I see what you mean, how a reflection is even less active than that kind of response. And yet, I think response has a nice quality of kind of dynamic activity. But I think the point that that I hear in your inquiry is particularly about, well, is the dual mirror making some kind of intentional effort to respond? And I would say no, it's not. It's just it's natural. It's a natural response.
I don't get it, you know, but I think I have to just sort of...
Reflection and response. I think that's an interesting thing. If we're not talking about an intentional response, then are they actually that different? They're different, you know, metaphors for talking about something that's not in these words, but they both have a slightly different quality. And I think we could say that Buddha nature is responsive. There's a Zen koan that brings up this issue of talking about the Dharmakaya, the Buddha's pure Dharma body. Like, we could say the full flowering of Buddha nature, completely revealed as the inconceivable Dharma body awareness of Buddha. And the story is about how does this Dharmakaya awareness respond to beings? And it's implied that it does. It responds to beings like the moon reflected in the water, like a donkey looking at a well, seeing its reflection in the well, like the well looking up at the donkey. So there's this... But the word response is actually used there. Yeah. In the koan, it's like, I think the actual the question, the inquiry of this one, of the one student in this story is, please explain the principle of response of the Dharmakaya, which is, I know that, you know, I won't say it's exactly the same as the dual mirror, but quite related. Reflection, response, yeah. Response and impetus.
Mm-hmm. It is giving it. Response is giving it a feel of a separate consciousness.
Yeah.
It's a separate thing, you know. So.
Well, separate from us, you mean?
It feels.
Yeah.
I remember when we were talking about Buddha nature, somebody. Last year or so, somebody brought this up at Tassajara and said, it sounds like you're kind of personifying, like, Buddha nature is some kind of being. Mm-hmm. And but you could say, we're talking about our nature here. Mm-hmm. It's not somebody else, like some sort of godlike figure that's responding to us. This mystical communion also sounds like it's somebody up or around or out there. But I think we're talking about the mystical communion between our own nature of mind and the dualistic appearances of our mind. So there's no body out there. Or Buddha is not apart from us, right? We hear it.
For the value of the word response. Because to me, it's about relationship. It's like to think that it's just this passive mirror doesn't match my experience.
It could sound
there
too passive.
There is interactivity, and you know, and I would even say that I like the concept of mystical communion with great nature. But I'm a, you know.
But remember that our relationship of, you know, us as a sentient being and Buddha is not like a usual relationship of like me and you as seemingly separate beings.
No, but it's like, you know, if you're really like despondent, say, and you go out and you go to the ocean and you just turn your being to the waves. I mean, that's not passive. There's a You know, and one could say it's all projection, but it's nourishing, right?
And I think it brings, this inquiry and response and mystical communion bring out a kind of devotional quality that, in Zen, sometimes we don't hear this. You can look at almost at the practice of Zazen as kind of a, almost a scientific kind of like, mind training exercise. And I think that misses some of the, the warmth of a kind of I think this is what we mean by devotion to Buddha. It's very easy to turn that devotion into a dualistic separation of there's Buddha over there on the altar and we're going to bow to that Buddha. But in Zen we have the verse that you can silently recite as you're prostrating to the Buddha on the altar. It goes, bower and bowed to are empty in nature, or are not two. Bower and bow to empty in nature, not two. Bower. I think the original verse may be longer. Bower and bow to are empty in nature, still. And non-dual, and then it goes on. I don't remember exactly how it goes, but like, I vow to take refuge in Buddha in this way, something like this. Yeah, but the part about bower and bow to are empty and still in nature. Self and other are not two. Bower and bow to empty and still in nature, self and other, not to. And thus we bow.
Relying from the real Chen keeps on coming up in all different situations, the oneness of giver, receiver, and gift. The oneness of Buddha, the person bows and bows.
Yeah, like that.
The oneness of the mirror and the object and the reflection.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. They're not separate, and yet when you mix them, you know where they are. You can still say, this is the giver and this is the gift.
I'm not sure, but another way for response would be just something happens. Mm-hmm. Which is what it feels like to me, so that it feels not that different than reflection. Just something happens. If I polish the wood, it responds. Something happens.
The wood responds. That's nice. To your polishing.
You know, the question is practice. So put it in Zen terms or musical terms or whatever. When you practice, and over time, there is a response. I mean, what it is or how you name it, but something happens, something changes. You're different, you know. You gain technique, you gain awareness, you know. So I get this sense, definitely, and I'm very happy kind of to accept out of this mystery, there is a response. I mean, I don't know, it's all right with me, but I mean, if we're getting very, you know, particular, you know, with nothing meeting, you know, there is no meetings and nothing, you know, ever. It just gets nitpicky in a way, you know.
Well, there's always the two sides, you know. Nothing ever meets, and yet we can distinguish me meeting you.
Right.
These are the two truths, and always going back and forth. And we start to like settle into becoming more comfortable with one truth or the other. I think this is why they're always playing with this. Zen koans are also always back and forth. You start to, and then, you know, you start to fall into one side and something gets pointed out. We flip into the other side and then we start to get stuck there and we flip back. So,
But I get something out of practicing. I get something.
Yeah, you could call that a response, yeah. The response from, we don't know exactly where from, but it's, you could say, it's not you.
Yeah.
Or,
it is.
It is you. The meaning is not in the words. Yeah, a response to the inquiring bullets. So again, words are going to keep coming up, but
but
to go back to the record of Dongshan, our author here, to tie together this issue of suchness that he's bringing up at the beginning, and words, and all kind of related to this dual mirror samadhi. And to just get to know Dongshan a little bit better. After practicing a long time with his teacher Yun Yen, Dongshan's now about to leave and go off on his own. So just before leaving, Dongshan asked, if after many years, someone should ask how I should portray the master's likeness, how I should portray you, teacher, how should I respond? And part of what's implied here is that he's received this entrustment of suchness. He's received the transmission of Dharma from his teacher, and now he's going to go out into the world and try to pass it on. But he asks, they have this relationship, right? If after many years from now somebody asks me how I should portray your likeness, or, you know, what was your true teaching, teacher, what should I tell them? After remaining quiet for a while, Yun Yen said, just this person. Classic Zen answer. How should I portray you? Just this person, which is another way of talking about the teaching of thusness. I am just thus, just like this, just this person, just this, plain and simple, sweet and true. One nice little like footnote about this that adds a little nuance to just this person, which is a just great line in itself, and this might destroy it a little bit for you, I don't know. But apparently, when you go into the Chinese for this, it means just this person of Han Dynasty China, and it's apparently the nuance of this character, part of the meaning of it, is it's like it's the response that a criminal in a court case gives to admit their guilt. So in a court, like, do you plead innocent or guilty? Just this person. Did you do it or not? Did you do this crime or not? Just this person. I fully avow. So it has this sense of kind of like confession, instead of like, wait, because you might hear it like, how should I portray you? Just this person, isn't it magnificent? A Buddha like this. It's more like, sorry, just this person, guilty for even saying so. You could say is a little bit of the implication. You asked me to say something, I paused for a while and you haven't left yet, so I guess I have to say something. Guilty. Something like that, just this person. Dongshan was then lost in thought. Which is kind of interesting that they put that in there too. Kind of like wondering about this. Lost in thought. The great Zen master, lost in thought. Yun Yen said, Acharya Dongshan, having assumed the burden of this great matter, you must be very cautious. So this might even be his teacher's line that prompted Dongshan to say, now you have it, so keep it well, protect and care for this. Because Yunyan saying, you have this great matter, which we could also call the jewel mirror, samadhi, you have to be very cautious, protect it well. Dongshan remained dubious about what Yunyan had said. He kept thinking about this, just this person issue. And later, as he was crossing a river, he saw his reflected image in the clear river and experienced a great awakening to the meaning of the previous words, the previous exchange with Yunyan. I once visited Dongshan Mount Dung in China, where this is the founder of the Cao Dong lineage in China. So you'd think it would be like a huge, magnificent monastery. Dongshan is like one of the most important ancestors in all of Chinese Zen, but it's this tiny little run-down place, very hard to even get to. Almost didn't make it there. Like a bunch of us piled in the back of this pickup truck, like on these muddy roads that you'd have to like get out at the mud puddles and stuff. And and all the paint's coming off the walls, and you get there and it's like there's only like maybe 5 monks living there. It's very small. They grow rice to support, rice fields out in front. And anyway, there's this stream that apparently was the stream that he saw his reflection in, which was quite far from Yunyan. So it was interesting to kind of like map it out. And so they had this conversation, but then he walked like maybe hundreds of miles. Or it wasn't like later that day, right? It was like some time later. He's still considering this exchange about just this person. And it's not even clear where he was going, right? But it's a very rural place in the mountains, and there's this mountain stream, and there's a bridge over it that you have to go over to get to the temple. And it's called Meeting Him or Encountering Him Bridge, coming from this story, this verse that Dongshan has this awakening, seeing his reflection, writes this verse. It says, earnestly avoid seeking without. Diligently, do not look outside yourself. So hard to, we have to be really diligent because we're always looking outside, right? Earnestly avoid seeking without, lest it recede far from you. Today I walk alone, yet everywhere I meet him or encounter him. It's called the Encountering Him Bridge over this river. He is now no other than myself, but I am not now him. It must be understood in this way in order to merge with suchness or lustness. So his awakening verse is about merging with suchness. So he goes on to write this poem about the teaching of suchness. And of course these lines are going to come up in the poem from this verse. He's going to quote, you are not it, it actually is you. It's him or it, you could translate either way. So you could actually translate it, earnestly avoid seeking outside, lest it recede far from you. Today I walk alone, yet everywhere I meet it, the jewel mirror. I'm walking alone, but everywhere I go, I take this mirror with me. It now is not other than me, but I am now not it. It must be understood in this way in order to merge with suchness. So I think we can come back to the you are not it, it is you when we get to those lines in the poem. I also wanted to bring up this part about just this person. So now this is later. So it's also interesting that if that really was the place in the river, Dongshan's walking along, he has this awakening, and then he basically stops walking and builds a temple right there. I don't think there was already a temple there. He's just in the mountains. It was already called Mount Dong, a cave mountain. It's like he stopped. He's like, I don't need to go anywhere anymore. Stop here, right where I am. You know, the temple's probably 100 yards from the river where he saw his reflection. So then later, he builds this temple, and he's doing a monthly memorial service, making the offerings for his teacher, like we do here for our teachers, yeah, our deceased teachers. So this is later, during a memorial service in front of Yunyan's portrait. Like, we put up the portrait of the teacher, make offerings. They did this in Dongshan's time. A monk asked during this ceremony, when your former teacher said, just this person, was it actually just this? Dongshan said, it was. The monk said, well, what did he mean? What did he mean with those words? And Dongshan said, at that time he said that, I nearly misunderstood my former teacher's intent. Maybe that's why he was lost in thought at that time. The monk said, I wonder if your former teacher actually knew reality. And Dongshan said, if he didn't know reality, how could he have answered in that way? But if he did know reality, why was he willing to answer that way? Because if he didn't know reality, how could he have said, just this person? But if he did know reality, how could he have said, just this person? Remember last week we talked about that story of I am always clearly aware and words don't reach it. How could he have been willing to say, to defile the pure Dharma by saying, just this person?
The monk wouldn't leave.
Maybe, that's why. And maybe there's that nuance that maybe it was like, excuse me, I'm guilty for saying so, but just this person. Later at another monthly memorial for Yunyan, a monk asked, what teaching did you receive while you were at Yunyan's place? Dongshan said, although I was there for a while, I didn't receive any teachings. The monk said, since you didn't actually receive any teaching, why are you conducting this memorial service? Why are you honoring this great teacher? You didn't even get anything from him. Dongshan said, why should I turn my back on him? And then the monk said, if you began your Zen studies with Nanchuan, which he did, Dongshan practiced with another great teacher, Nanchuan, before he met Yunyan, he said, well, you probably got something from Nanchuan, right? Why don't you conduct why do you conduct this memorial ceremony for Yunyan instead of Nanchuan? And Dongshan says, it's not my former teacher's virtue or Buddha Dharma that I esteem. It's only that he did not make exhaustive explanations for me. Thus, he is my true teacher. Nanchuan actually taught me a lot before I went to Yunyan's. When I got to Yunyan's, he never actually explained anything really for me. And that's why he's my true teacher. Because the meaning is not in the words. And because words don't reach it. And over, I finally got that. When I was with Nanchuan, he explained it, and I really got what he said. And I really thought that those words reached it. And then later went to Yunyan, I saw, actually, like, I don't know what's going on here anymore. So he was my true teacher. Later, then the monk goes on to say, well, since you're doing this memorial ceremony for Yunyan, do you agree with him or not? And Dongshan said, I agree with half and don't agree with half. Or half agree and half don't agree. And the monk said, why don't you agree completely? And Dungjan said, if I agreed completely, then I would be ungrateful to my former teacher. So that's another little addendum about the teacher-student relationship. If we agree completely, I'd be ungrateful to him. And actually, the lineage would quickly die out. Mm-hmm. By the way, this is a picture of Dungshan holding up his robes so they, because as he's crossing the river, so they don't get wet, and he's looking down. They don't, you can't see his reflection, but he's looking at it.
Can you translate that to some element in his mind that he's keeping part of his mind open and inquisitive, not honest?
That he doesn't completely agree?
Yeah.
Yeah. It could be like, yeah, there's some things he said that I still have to investigate.
Yeah.
Could be part of it. Yeah. I agree with half and don't agree with half. That's a beautiful statement. It's not like I disagree completely. Then there's no connection at all. But he is thus, and I am thus too, and yet we're separate. We're two different herons walking in the same moonlight. Both white, but different. You can tell where they are. It responds to the inquiring impulse. Move and you are trapped. Miss and you fall into doubt and vacillation. Or we used to, another translation is, if you're excited, it becomes a pitfall. If you miss it, you fall into retrospective hesitation. Or another word for this pitfall or trap is cliché. So if you get excited about it and try to get a hold of it, it becomes a cliché. Dual-mirror samadhi, come on, isn't everybody on board? And I was like, we just keep talking about the dual-mirror samadhi, and the dual-mirror samadhi, dual-mirror samadhi. Starts to become a cliché. We forget that it's actually, we're talking about our true nature. It's just words. The words can easily become cliché. That's why, after we're done studying this, we'll tear it up and study something else. So we don't get stuck in it. It's the dual mirror samadhi. It's so precious, this mirror. This is it. That's kind of like getting excited, too excited. But also miss. If you miss it, you fall into retrospective hesitation. Like, as I think a nice way to say it, like you're looking back, like, I missed it. Where was it? It's gone. There it goes. Or doubt and vacillation. And then similarly, the next line, turning away and touching are both wrong, for it's like a massive fire. Again, these two sides. We say that grasping and rejecting. Turning away is like ignoring. This is too difficult. This is Zen study. Let's just go sit. Well, we might be like, are we avoiding it? Are we turning away? And touching came up in this... in our Hungjur's acupuncture needle of Zazen poem, in that last sesshin, there's the wonderful line in the kind of central line about talking about the mind of Zazen or the mirror awareness. He says, it's like knowing without touching things, illumining without facing objects. There's this mind of Zazen. Knowing without touching things. It's the same character. So Hongzhi, who came later, might have been influenced even by this dual mirror samadhi poem. Touching things, meaning like, oh, this is where we had this conversation about meeting. I think it was around this verse in the poem about touching things. Things don't actually, in non-duality, mind doesn't touch objects. Mind doesn't contact or meet objects. But this awareness is not just blank, everything is turned off. It's knowing. It's a kind of knowledge It's a non-dual knowing. Non-dual because it doesn't touch things. The mind doesn't touch things, and yet it knows. I think literally in the Chinese poem, it's like, not touching, yet knowing. So here it's, turning away and touching are both wrong, for it's like a massive fire. I think you could say it is referring back to the teaching of suchness or to this dual mirror. There's lots of its in this poem. I think both of those are different names for the same thing. This mirror awareness, which is like, let's change the metaphor now. Instead of this cool, reflective, almost passive mirror, now it's like a raging fire, right? It's like this blazing fire. If you turn away from it and walk away, you'll freeze to death. You'll just get very cold because it's the source of our life warmth. But if you try to touch the fire, you get burned. Touching it, I would say mainly in this case, is like thinking that the meaning is in the words. Touching it with like, here it is, the massive fire, the dual mirror awareness. Got it. That's like, we're trying to touch it with our concepts. And I think that's what Hong Jiri means in that poem, too. Zazen mind is knowing without touching things, touching with conceptual. That's what touches, actually. External objects are touched by dualistic conceptual mind.
I appreciate what you said about the fire that we need to stay close to to get the warmth, but not so close that we get crispy.
Yeah.
I somehow misunderstood that before. I thought of a raging fire. I want to face it so I know where I am in relationship to it, because if I turn my back,
You might get burnt from behind.
Yes.
Yeah.
So
you're facing it, and yet it's this issue of not grasping or rejecting. What's our relationship to this awareness? Our relationship to the awareness, right? We could say we are the awareness, but in terms of like the sense of like there's me here now and the dual mirror awareness, the mirror that's hanging on my back, whatever.
So I thought of it like this fire, and I needed to be very aware of it to be in relationship with it.
And that's, you think that's not the case now?
I really like the reinterpretation that we need the warmth of the fire.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't know if it's so much about like where you could say being aware of it as an object is kind of like almost touching it actually. So it's more like we're just basking in its warmth. We're not trying to even keep an eye on it. I think keeping an eye on the mirror, it separates. If we're talking about the mirror, we try to see the mirror, we're just going to see our own reflection. We can't see the mirror, it's too shining. We just see the reflection. But we can just rest in the mirror, as the mirror. This is the subtlety of this mind of Zazen. Not getting a hold of it and not just forgetting about it either. We talk about turning the light of awareness around back to the mirror. It's not exactly like we're turning it around so that we can touch the mirror with this light of dualistic awareness. It's more we're just receding back into this spaciousness. I think I mentioned recently that if we're having trouble getting touching the fire at all, which is a good thing to have trouble touching it, I think, then just to relax into the sense of spaciousness. We're just sitting, and the fire, we're mixing all these metaphors here, right? With the mirror and this fire is like a big, warm spaciousness that has no characteristics. and yet it's not nothing.
Another way consider it might be to be the fire.
Hmm. Yes. Yes. Being the fire is not touching the fire, right? It's certainly not turning away. And I think that's true. Being the fire is not touching the fire, because you are the fire. So yes, yeah.
And no separation.
No separation. And in fact, that is the practice of the dual mirror awareness, is to just be that awareness. So, yes, well said. Yeah. Be it. Be the fire. Which reminds me of the story about suchness and the mirror awareness last week, right? Of like, when it's cold, the cold kills you. When it's hot, the heat kills you. How do you avoid hot and cold, right? You just become them completely. So, same thing. If we become the cold completely, then it's actually not cold. But if there's a little separation from it, then it's really cold. we're touching, the cold is touching us, and it's not a pleasant touch. How do we become our experience, whatever our experience is, become the experience completely? And the kind of the irony is that we are our experience already. It's just we're never separate from it. But we, our minds can do this amazing thing of like bifurcating. Like we seem to be separate from our experience. What was it? Maybe it was Joko Beck. He said something like, I think it was defining enlightenment. Somebody asked, what's enlightenment? And she said, something like, when you're not separate from your experience at all. Something like that. I thought that's pretty good, straightforward, simple, and difficult practice. We could also say, when you don't identify with your experience as, you know, you having an experience. We could say you are identical with your experience, is no separation, but identify with means like I'm having a painful experience, and like I am identified with that experience, where we've separated the I out from the experience. So I think that's another way of saying it. When the self is not separated out, sense of the individual self is not separated out from the experience that's happening. Which is often seems the case, where like there's the experience and then there's like this kind of like self that's like assessing things, assessing how it's going. Like it removes itself from the view. How is this experience going? Kokyo? Oh, not so good actually. Thank you for asking. It's like we do this, right? We have these conversations with ourself. It's amazing. Amazing we can do it, but you could say that's the basic delusion. And I think also maybe you could even say we can still do that because it's a very natural thing for the mind to do, but if we kind of get the joke of like, how are you doing today, Kokyo? Oh, I'm fine, how are you? Oh, I'm fine, how are you? Wait, what's the difference between me and you anyway? Oh, I don't know, I never thought about that before. Oh, why don't you take a look? I don't know, it might be kind of scary, maybe But maybe we're like really actually closer than you think. Maybe. But I have better things to do today. like make some more judgments about you. and all those other people out there. If I start to get tired doing it with you, I'll start doing it about all them. It's more fun to do with them, because this gets pretty painful. Just to depict it, I think our sutra book actually says, just to depict it in literary form is to stain it with defilement, or portray it. Same thing. Literary form, apparently the Chinese there means something like especially flowery, poetic words. So maybe Dongchan's even sort of making fun of himself. He's like, I'm writing this, remember this poem is like, the last word in each of these lines rhymes to the entire poem. So he's really choosing words in order to make them rhyme, and they have this, they all have the same number of characters and so on. So he's writing this very poetic, flowery thing, and so he's saying, but if you depict it in this literary, flowery language, it stains it with defilement. Sort of like teasing himself maybe a little bit. And it's bright just at midnight, it doesn't appear at dawn. So this is where now it's is maybe starting to get into this issue of these five positions of relative and ultimate. Now, one, we can get into this next week, but one theory from Tigan, and I don't know if he got this from somebody else, Tigan Leighton, is relative and ultimate, the characters that are used in the five positions of Dongshan, is this character that means, for ultimate, actually means true. He chooses a particular, it's more like true, or you could say truth, and kind of like leaning for like ultimate and relative is like upright. I know that you could also translate upright and inclined is like ultimate and relative, or true and partial maybe is a way to access it. And anyway, this character for true, that's the, like used in the, as the ultimate in the five ranks, there's five times in this poem where that character, true, appears. And according to Taigen, these are the five positions in these five lines where true appears. Taigen has this essay called Dongshan and the Teaching of Suchness in a collection of essays where he mentions this. So this is the first case. It's not even in the translation, right? I think we should, to include it, we should say, it is truly bright just at midnight. But in the line, the Chinese lines there, it's the third character from the left. It says like, those characters read like, night, middle, truly bright. And that true, if you look at that character, you can go down and find five more times where that character appears. Exactly five. So they're not like, you know, evenly spaced or anything. But we can talk about this as we get to each line. But this is an issue now here of like, we're talking about relative and ultimate because we're talking about the light and dark, right? So it's bright just at midnight means like there's the relative in the relative light of brightness in the dark of midnight. And it doesn't appear at dawn means like this truth, when light comes into the room, this truth, the ultimate truth disappears because now we see all the distinctions. So the truth is truly shining bright in the darkness, but when dawn comes, it's hidden. When the world of differentiation appears, the truth is hidden. But we could say, and in the middle of the night, the truth is bright. Maybe that would be a way to talk about, we're talking about the first of these five positions. The first of the five ranks, or five positions of Dongshan, are called, we'll just end with this, just so you get a sense of it. And if you have this, there's extensive stuff on it in this Charlie Bacorny's thing. But the relative within the true, or, you know, the partial or relative within the true is the first rank or position, the first first relationship of relative and ultimate is called the relative within the ultimate. And that's what's could be being pointed out here. The brightness in the dark, the relative in the true. The second position is the true within the relative. The third is coming from within the true. The fourth is going within together, the true and the relative. And the fifth is arriving within together. It's one version. So that might not make any sense if you've never heard about this, what's going on there. As we're going to do a whole other class series on these five positions in the summer because it's quite complex. But relative within the true, this first might be the simplest, is within the darkness, or you could say, again, let's talk from our experience of awareness. Within the dual mirror, a non-dual awareness, we suddenly have an experience of like a zendo and people. And here it is. This is the relative world coming forth, or we could say within the true. Or the, it's like a bunch of herons within the big moonlight. Or a bunch of beautiful snowflake people within the silver bowl. You could say that's all talking about the relative within the true. The first position. By the way, there's a case 13 in the Blue Cliff Record collection of koans is a kind of a strange koan. A monk asks Ba Ling, I think is his name, what is the school of Kanadeva? Is this Indian ancestor Kanadaiba Dayosho, who is the disciple of Nagarjuna in old Indian lineage. Nagarjuna is like the main expounder of these two truths, the emptiness teachings and one of the great early people who really brought out this Mahayana version of how these two truths of ultimate and relative work together. And his student who continued to write about emptiness and the two truths is Kanadeva, or Aryadevas is another name of him. So the monk asks, what's the school? I think he says, what's the school of Kanadeva? And Ba Ling says, filling a silver bowl with snow, or a silver bowl filled with snow. So, interesting that, like, what's this Indian, you could say, what's the school of Kanadevas? Like, what's the essence of the Madhyamaka school of Indian philosophy? That's Kanadeva and Nagarjuna school. And the Zen answer, instead of like, well, it's the teachings of emptiness and dependent co-arising and the way that relative and ultimate truths interact. Instead, the Zen answer is the Madhyamaka school of India. It's like filling a silver bowl with snow. Yeah. That's right. This time we're studying Dungshan instead of Gardena. He'll come up again. We offer any positive energy generated in this inquiry and response meeting to the great awakening of all beings. May they fully appreciate their present mirror awareness. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. To enter them, Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become